and my fellow Pennsylvanians.
This state's electoral votes are key to who wins the presidency, and both of the candidates know it.
We win Pennsylvania, we win the whole deal. You know that. Just like last time.
But states like Pennsylvania are going to be incredibly important.
The only thing left on the board is Pennsylvania. The president cannot get to the finish line without the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
One state all four candidates are visiting today is Pennsylvania. Its 20 electoral votes are highly coveted, and the Keystone State could end up being one of the determining factors in the race.
Jill's a Philly girl, but I'm a Scranton girl.
A lot's still a big question mark in PA politics this Wednesday morning, but we decided to record now anyway. We also decided to leave the analysis of the top of the ticket for others to discuss. Our conversation today is going to get granular, and we're going to go region by region. This is our hallmark. This is what we've been doing for over a year with this podcast. I'm joined by two great reporters who I literally start my day with 5 days a week, John Misick and Justin Schweitzer. They have great perspective on all elements of PA politics, but in particular know every nook and cranny of the State House and State Senate. The themes we discuss about the shifting base of each party have been bubbling for some time. Last night, these themes came to a boil. So I'm looking forward to unpackaging all of this with John and Justin.
Good morning, I think. It's still morning? Morning.
Yeah, I'm a little out of sorts this morning myself, but we made it.
There's so many places we could take this discussion. I was frankly even debating whether or not we postpone, but then we heard the news out of Allegheny County that it's not going to be until Friday at 9 a.m. that they're going to have anything. There's some other counties that have outstanding questions. So I think listeners are very eager to plunge right in, get granular. I think we might as well start in York County. We have a lot of listeners in the greater capital region and just really some monumental just shakeups in York County. So who wants to take that?
I'll jump in. I mean, we saw Stan, yes, John Misick from the Pennsylvania Capital Star. We saw Stan Saylor, the House Appropriations Committee chairperson, getting knocked off last night, challenged from his right by a person called Wendy Fink. Just amazing. The Citizens Alliance for Pennsylvania, which is this right-wing group that, you know, kind of enforcers of orthodoxy, went after Saylor hard for not being, you know, sufficiently a defender of the true faith, and actually caught the car, which was not something that I would have expected. And you had a guy who's been around Harrisburg for decades, the center of budget negotiations, really good at raising money, yet still, you know, not able to overcome this kind of rightward shift in the party, and he came out at the wrong end of it on Tuesday night.
Yeah, we had a conversation in the fall. I mean, you had a school board election in New York County that became a national. There was even international news media coverage. So it is fascinating what's happening there. I know that the York County GOP chairman actually just resigned today as well. So a lot happening. Where, you know, Justin, you know, actually, before we start, guys, give folks just a quick background. Shame on listeners if they don't know these two excellent reporters. I start my days reading their material. But Justin, start us off. Tell us a little about your background and your publication, and then John, off to you.
Yeah, I'm a Harrisburg-based reporter at a city and state PA. So we do a mix of digital coverage and print magazine work. And I've been covering the state capitol for a little over 3 years now. So not as grizzled as John over here, but I'm working my way there.
Yeah, I'm John Misick. I'm editor of the Pennsylvania Capital Star. We're lucky enough to have a content sharing partnership with Justin's publication, so we're privileged to run their stuff. We've been in existence for about 3.5 years now, 100% digital, focused on Pennsylvania government, politics, and policy. We're part of the state's newsroom network. Now have state capital operations in 24 states, just opened up in Alaska just this last week. And Justin correctly points out that I am perhaps a little older than he is. I've been covering the Capitol now for 20 something years in one guise or another.
I think that's a great way to pivot. You both have a Lehigh Valley connection, as do I, and quite a bit to talk about in and around Allentown. So maybe we'll take the discussion from York and we'll work our way up 222 to there. So I think two different lenses that I'm personally curious. We have the federal side, with the congressional race probably being one of the most purple east of the Mississippi, and then just some really fascinating dynamics with the state Senate races. So who wants to take that out?
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting district to start off with is the 7th Congressional District. You know, that's where incumbent Representative Susan Wild currently serves. And there was a GOP primary that included a primary opponent or a Republican opponent that Wild faced 2 years ago, Lisa Scheller, you know, a local businesswoman. And she came in with, you know, what seemed like a lot of establishment support this time around. I believe she got an endorsement from Kevin McCarthy, another from Mike Pompeo. So I think this cycle, she really picked up some steam that she may not have had the last time around. And I haven't checked the results on that this morning, but that did look like a really close race between her and Kevin Deliker, another local Lehigh Valley resident who has, you know, some military experience. And I think, at least from my vantage point, I wasn't expecting that one to be as close as it was. But, you know, I did drive through rural Lehigh County, not to use the yard sign test here, but I was surprised by how many Deliker signs I saw around. So I think maybe that might speak, you know, at least a little bit to, you know, his standing in, you know, certain communities. I know, I believe his dad is a local school board leader, or was a local school board leader in Western Lehigh County for a time. So when the dust clears on this one, I think it will be interesting to see how Wild stands, given that her district has been changed up a bit, you know, with the new congressional map. I believe some analyses of that district described it as being a little more conservative this time around. So I think Wild's going to face a pretty tough race this fall. And, you know, if Scheller, you know, if she ends up the nominee, again, I haven't looked at Lehigh Valley this morning, but, you know, I think she could roll into the general with a stronger campaign this time around.
Yeah, I mean, Scheller came in to Tuesday better funded than Deliker by a lot. So I mean, I agree with Justin that I was a little surprised by the closeness of the result. I mean, I've always been fascinated by the 7th district and its prior iteration as the 15th. It's always been sort of the canary in the coal mine for Democratic chances, you know, statewide, represented by Charlie Dent for a bunch of years in the old 15th district, a traditional sort of moderate Republican before that Democratic surge, the remap in 2018, where four seats flipped. And if I'm remembering correctly, I mean, Wild's seat is one of those that is most specifically on the bubble this cycle, in no small part, as Justin said a moment ago, because of the remapping there. They like peeled off some parts, I think, down in like Bucks, and then moved them further north into kind of redder territory. So she'll be running in a reconfigured.
Yeah, she has to get to know Carbon County voters.
And Carbon County is bright, bright red up there in the Slate Belt. So it's an entirely different district to the one that she's used to running in. That said, I mean, it is still difficult to knock off a congressional incumbent. The time to have done it would have been in her first term. She's now running for a third, am I counting correctly? Second, third? Yeah, so would have been, so 18, 20, 20, 22, 20. Yeah, so running for a third term, you know, a few more times around the block, and she'll have sort of D-trip resources behind her and all of that stuff, which is not to say that it's not going to be a tough run for her, because obviously Scheller is a really committed candidate.
But, it, you know, it is fascinating, and then we'll boomerang to a different part of the Commonwealth, guys, but it is fascinating that, I mean, as I saw, it was $32,000 that Kevin Deliker had. I mean, I guess he spent them on some yard signs, among other things, but up against $1.2 million that by and large Lisa Scheller wrote herself. It just seems like there's a real question of Lehigh Valley GOP unity, and a lot can happen and a lot will happen between now and mid-October to bring the party together. But that's whereas the Democratic, Susan Wild, the congresswoman, didn't have a primary challenge. So why don't we just boomerang down to Chester County? Because potentially that congressional seat, which is largely Chester County. I think there's some of Berks that's held by Chrissy Houlihan that also came in 2018. That was a fascinating GOP race with, frankly, even a Nazi who was running, or someone who certainly had some strong affinities for Nazis. But it looks like maybe Guy Ciarocchi is going to be the nominee. But what do you all think? I mean, how purple is that going to be?
I think Guy is an interesting candidate in this race because I know it seemed like he was very well liked when he ran, when he began his campaign for governor. You know, he has the background with the Chester County Chamber of Commerce, I believe. And so I think he presents as, you know, a very business savvy kind of, I mean, he's not a purple candidate, he's conservative, but I think he, you know, has a type of appeal that I think could be attractive to Collar County voters. I haven't focused into this race too heavily. John, I don't know if you have much to add on this one.
No, I mean, the only thing I recall about the sixth for, you know, until Chrissy Houlihan came along, that had always been a hairball for Democrats. That was what Ryan Costello's seat for a lot of years, a very sort of Guy Ciarocchi kind of Republican. So, I mean, there is certainly that history there of them electing those kinds of people or those sorts of Republicans to Congress, pardon me, long night still threading together my thoughts. But, you know, we've also had sort of that blue shift down there over the last couple of cycles with Democrats capturing, I think they now have all four county courthouses in the collar counties. So, you know, there has been that that demographic and voting shift there. So you can't immediately rule out Chrissy Houlihan as well. I like Justin, I am not as plugged in on this race, but, you know, it looks like at first blush, there's a lot of stuff that might be breaking Houlihan's way, but, you know, in the time that we're in now, who the heck can tell with any of these campaigns?
Well, that's, I think, the point, right? I mean, I don't think a lot of people were necessarily looking at this, certainly in Washington. But, you know, all of a sudden, you have someone who comes from the business community and theoretically has access to resources. So it could very well be a pretty contentious congressional race. I guess since we're in Southeast PA, if we could move over to Philadelphia. Hopefully listeners are buckled up. We're not getting whiplash as we're jumping around. But so in the city of Philadelphia and then also in Delaware County, there's definitely tea leaves to read and to unpackage. But before, guys, we totally forgot about another major story in the Lehigh Valley with a fairly important and powerful fella in Harrisburg for quite a few years. So let's boomerang back up 476.
Yeah, no, I think the news that really struck me last night, you know, I think a lot of us expected someone like Doug Mastriano to succeed. But then when you look down ballot, you know, there appears to be a rightward shift in certain races. And that was definitely evident with State Senator Pat Brown, who chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee and is a, you know, big time Harrisburg veteran, very, you know, kind of financially savvy figure in the Capitol. And, you know, Brown has always been interesting to watch because he's a conservative guy, but he also has a moderate streak at times with some certain issues, particularly socially around LGBTQ issues. And it, you know, last time I looked, it looked like he's about to get knocked off by, you know, a challenger who's further to the right than him. I believe it's a Parkland school board member who, you know, kind of ran on an anti-critical race theory, anti-mask type of campaign. And, you know, it kind of mirrors the Stan Saylor race as well that we touched on. You know, these are two, you know, big time Harrisburg veterans, conservatives, you know, especially in Saylor's case. I mean, he's no moderate. And we saw, you know, both of these Harrisburg vets get knocked off by kind of, you know, anti-establishment, further right candidates. And, you know, I think it speaks to, you know, a bit of a shift we're seeing in the Pennsylvania Republican Party right now. You know, obviously we saw that with Mastriano, but I think we're seeing that down ballot as well. And I think, you know, it's pretty evident in the Lehigh Valley just based on that one race, because, you know, Brown's been here forever. And the span of 4 years, the political headwinds completely shifted against him. And, you know, he looks like he's going to need to find another job.
Yeah, I'm looking at the numbers here. This guy, Jared Coleman, who is the apparent winner in that race, 10,302 votes to Brown's 9,196. So he didn't run away with it, but it, you know, it was pronounced enough a victory there. And Brown has had some health misadventures over the last couple of years as well. tied to his fondness for motorcycle riding. He had a couple of bad run-ins. So maybe that was something that was playing into voters' minds as well. You know, I don't know. But again, it's certainly extraordinary for someone of his position and seniority to be to lose his party's nomination. But Justin is right; it is indicative of this sort of broader rightward shift that we've been talking about in a lot of these races here.
I think we're also seeing that money can't buy you love, as the song goes. Two Harrisburg institutions haven't looked at the campaign finance reports, but I need to imagine umpteen more times than these soon to be incumbent members.
Maybe Justin has a better idea than I do. I don't know what kind of campaigns these guys were running, Saylor and Brown, if they thought they could just sort of go on cruise control and win re-election. Sometimes it's just a matter of outworking the other guy. If you're out there knocking doors and dropping off mailers and doing all that stuff, that can sometimes, you know, make the difference too.
Yeah, I haven't dug into the campaign finance reports or anything in those races yet, but I think there was a bit of anti-establishment sentiments thrown around in Saylor's race in particular, because, you know, I remember hearing some gas tax criticism. You know, he voted for a big infrastructure package years ago. And yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, as John mentioned, it just came down to effort. You know, I certainly kind of took a step back from looking at these races. You know, I was like, they're two powerful incumbents, you know, whatever. And, you know, lo and behold, they get, you know, they both get knocked off. And, you know, I'm curious if they took the same approach that I did to covering these, because it definitely surprised me last night when I was, you know, kind of poking around into the different.
And I think as of this morning, we're not going to touch on all of these, but it's 9 incumbents that are behind or definitively lost against folks. I do want to clarify something I said. That Pat Brown seat, which is no longer a Pat Brown seat, in theory is somewhat purple and will be a contest in November. But the Stan Saylor one, I mean, this is no longer a Stan Saylor one, but it's definitively a red seat. So this cuts both ways, guys. You have down in Philadelphia, you had all sorts of candidates from the left challenging sitting incumbents. There was also a Delaware County seat. So specifically, there were two incumbents, one in Delaware County that lost to a Working Families Party member, and then one, Pam Delisio in the city of Philadelphia, that lost to Tariq Khan. So maybe we can talk a little about that, you know, because sometimes, obviously, a victory is a victory, but coming up short and laying that ground game, it just seems like something's definitely happening in Philadelphia where people are happy to kind of run against the ward infrastructure and come with this hard left mentality.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of interesting. In Philly, I was just talking about this WHYY a little while ago. I mean, you saw the city committee opt against endorsing a lot of incumbents in hard-fought races down there, like Liz Fiedler and Chris Rabb, and, you know, endorsing these other, you know, sort of more these other challengers, some of whom were more moderate and mainstream, and that just turned out not to be where the mood of the electorate was. You know, Rabb's race was a little different because he was running in that reconfigured 200th House district down there against Isabella Fitzgerald, his colleague from the neighboring 203rd district, I think, and he ended up coming out at the right end of it last night. I mean, we saw that out west as well, where the Allegheny County Democratic Committee opted against endorsing a bunch of House incumbents like Jessica Benham and Summer Lee, who's running for Congress, House member who's now running for Congress out there and looks like she might squeak out a win in her race as well. So it was just this weird thing where the party establishment really wasn't where the mood of the electorate was, and they just, you know, absolutely misread the tea leaves to deleterious effect, it looks like.
The Philly component is interesting too, because, you know, at least, you know, in Fiedler's case, she's not, you know, new. This isn't her, you know, first race for the state house, and she was obviously successful previously. And you know, I think there's a range of opinions on the Philadelphia Democratic Committee and who they should and shouldn't be endorsing. But we saw success with these more, you know, left-wing progressive candidates in the past. We saw Nikhil Saval defeat State Senator Larry Farnese. And Saval is, I think he was DSA-backed. Fiedler was backed by the Democratic Socialists of America. Same thing in some of these Pittsburgh races where, you know, I think the party establishment, like John said, is saying one thing, you know, that, you know, maybe our area, you know, isn't as progressive or left-wing as you're painting it to be. But then you see voters say something else and elect candidates like Fiedler, like Rick Kurjewski, like Nikhil Saval. So, you know, I think there's a reckoning to be had in the Democratic Party as well, at least in terms of the direction in the state's urban cores and, you know, where these parties want to take it and who do they want to elect. And I think, you know, right now the progressives are winning, as you see, you know, up and down the ballot from Summerlee, if she pulls this off, and then down to state house and local ward races.
Yeah, we've had a lot of listener interest because, look, at the end of the day, if Democrats are going to, the statewide Fetterman and Shapiro, if they're going to win, they're going to need strong, enthusiastic Philadelphia turnout in November. So we've done several episodes on exactly these themes, and it certainly does seem, first time in my lifetime, that there's some major fissures in the Philadelphia Democratic City Committee and ward infrastructure. And we've mentioned some of these other organizations like the DSA and Working Families and Reclaim Philadelphia. As listeners know, although I don't want to assume because we have a lot of Washington and New York listeners and elsewhere, Northeast Philly is somewhat of its own entity. It's a wonderful place. I say that because my late mother's from there. But there was a fairly contentious race where a former Brendan Boyle staffer seems to be 19 points up, Anthony Belmont, African-American. So, and then there was also the state Senate race up there. But maybe we can talk a little about Northeast Philly. I mentioned it also because President Trump did quite well up there.
Yeah, I mean, that's Martina White country up there, John Purcell's seat for a long time. But then, you know, you also have the Boyle family holding court up there as well. So it's like that little pocket of like Northeast Philly where that Martina White represents is kind of that last outpost of Republicanism in Philadelphia. It's a really weird kind of like little chunk of the city.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the geography personally, but from what I do know, it's a little, in certain places, it's a little more conservative. Is that accurate?
So just to clarify for listeners, so Martina White's a Republican member of the State House and also in leadership. I think she has a bright future ahead. I don't even know that she's certainly not even 45. So, yeah, and you have anecdotally, but I think the demographics back it up. It's where you have a lot of police officers and the retired law enforcement, a lot of the labor households. Great. I think it makes sense to go all the way across the Commonwealth, unless I'm missing anything in Southeast PA, guys.
Actually, Ari, before we move off that, it looks like Tony Williams did survive. State Senator Tony Williams, Democrat from Philadelphia, is going to survive a primary challenge from his left. It's a little squeaky, but that would appear to be the case, is my understanding.
Yeah, we should definitely, I want to take a few minutes and talk about Senator Williams and then, for that matter, Congressman Evans. You know, I think even a few years ago, it would be unheard of. It would be complete heresy to challenge either of these really just pillars of Philadelphia Democratic politics and just really community leaders, but they both had some pretty well-funded, animated challengers.
Yeah, Senator Williams was tremendous. If you ask him, he will tell you he was tremendously aggrieved by the challenge from his left. His challenger brought up a lot of his
John,
support.
If you don't ask him, he might volunteer as well.
He was telling anyone and everyone by in the sort of active verb sense, not the action one undertakes in any way. But I mean, you know, he was taking a lot of heat for his pro-school choice votes, for his decisions to take money from Jeffrey Yass, that mega bucks donor from down in Bala Cynwyd, who was fire hosing money onto Republicans who are friendly to vouchers and school choice issues. I mean, through a certain lens, this is certainly understanding black city Democrats such as Tony Williams or the House Minority Leader Jordan Harris have been friendly to charters because often that is the only avenue to a quality education for the children of those people whom they represent. And, you know, when I asked Senator Williams about the criticism he was facing for this Jeffrey Yass money, he got quite aggrieved by the line of questioning and argued that he'd always been a supporter of public education. So, you know, that was a line of attack that his challenger came at him with. It does not, as again, as we sit here right now, it does not appear to have worked, and he's going to narrowly pull one out. But again, this goes, we're talking, this is sort of the common thread we're talking about here, about the shifts in both the Democratic and Republican electorate, one becoming on the right, Trumpier than thou, and one on the left, more aligned with the Nikhil Saviles and Liz Fiedlers and Summer Lees of the world.
I think it is interesting that these two races you mentioned, Ari, both Anthony Williams' state senate race and Dwight Evans' congressional race. I think these were two examples of, you know, the more left wing of the Democratic Party being unsuccessful in these challenges. And you know, like you guys said, you know, they're very much pillars of their community and pillars of the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania. But in Dwight Evans' case, you know, he had a very, I guess, a very well-publicized challenger. She ran a very non-traditional campaign.
She also outraised him, which is incredible. He's a member of the Ways and Means Committee and at least one fundraising quarter. She, at 28 years young, outraised him.
Right. Yeah. I think there was a lot of intrigue around her. Very progressive candidate. This is Alexandra Hunt, by the way, and supports Medicare for All, Green New Deal. Had a background as a dancer, I believe, and was using OnlyFans to raise money, which, I don't think Dwight Evans was on OnlyFans raising money, but, she pulled in, like you said, a lot of cash, but it looks like it ultimately didn't matter as, Evans is holding a pretty sizable lead over her right now. So, another instance where, the leftward shift might not be taking root.
Yeah, and I think it's good that we're having this discussion because, once again, if you're John Fetterman, if you're Josh Shapiro, and you want to win in the fall, you need hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Philadelphia Democrats energized and coming out. And that's a long way from now, so we're not going to focus on that. All right, so let's jump on over to Pennsylvania's second largest city, Pittsburgh, which had a bit of a bombshell a year ago when the incumbent mayor, Peduto, was defeated by a state house member. Ed Gainey, I think, is doing a great job right now, is 1 year or so into his tenure. But what was very interesting is you had the previous mayor endorse one candidate for Congress in this open seat, and you have the current mayor, Gainey, endorse another. And it looks like this race could be decided by 100 votes, but we're not going to know at the earliest until Friday. But let's just chew on that for a while, guys.
Yeah, I mean, in that race for the 12th congressional district, you had Steve Irwin, who is a little more kind of establishment mold Democrat, like you said, endorsed by Peduto, and I believe endorsed by, Rich Fitzgerald, the Allegheny County executive, and some unions out there as well. But there seemed to be a big ideological rift between Irwin and Summer Lee, the state representative from Braddock area. She had a lot of labor union support, and at times, some of these unions were really looking to frame Irwin as a union buster. There was also an influx of attention due to certain super PAC, I believe, that launched a lot of negative ads against Summer Lee. So this one was contentious, and it is very close at the moment. It looks like the votes split, mainly 4 or 5 different ways, but, Summer Lee and Steve Irwin racked up the majority of that. And I think, again, this could, in my view, kind of be a continuation of, the Ed Gainey success that we saw a couple of years ago. We saw Pittsburgh voters kind of fed up with, the Peduto administration, and they chose to elect not only a new mayor, but a black mayor who, might be more representative of the city's population. And, that's something that I think Lee has made clear as well, and that in all halls of power, she's always been a firm believer in, kind of diversifying who is in office and making Congress more reflective of the people they represent. So, if she pulls this off, I think there's a very clear line drawn from Gainey's success to her success, and that more progressive candidates are finding success in Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh voters are probably a bit frustrated with the status quo.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious to the extent to which, and Justin, perhaps you can speak to this, to the extent to which Jerry Dickinson, that Pitt law professor who's running kind of third, if that was a drag there, because he's fairly progressive as well, if that was, and I believe also is black, if that was a pull mm-hmm. on Lee's vote at all, to what extent voters might have split there. But I mean, I think you're absolutely right in your analysis. I mean, Lee has been in the forefront on a lot of issues, from minimum wage to labor fairness to police reform. And that's, you know, that obviously with the incidents that have taken place between police and the city's black population over the last couple of years, that is something that certainly resonates. And that's a shift away from sort of the white party establishment of Bill Peduto, and something that, you know, that Ed Gainey spoke to quite effectively in his mayoral bid. So she is, I think Justin is right, you can sort of draw that line between that the success of Ed Gainey and presumably the success of Summer Lee if she emerges from this victorious, which appears to be the case, but there are still, you know, votes out there that are yet to be counted.
So the two of you, frankly, have been in Harrisburg longer than State Representative Summer Lee has, but she certainly has made a splash. And you know, I haven't been at Harrisburg press conferences, but you hear you just hear stories. So maybe, I mean, because it does seem like it's quite possible she could be the next congresswoman. You know, we're going to find out definitively in a few days. But give listeners a preview, because that is a safe Democratic seat. We saw how long Congressman Doyle has been in D.C. So.
I mean, she works tremendously hard. She raises a lot of money. I mean, for somebody sort of coming from like the Democratic socialist ecosystem, she has not been shy about kind of using the traditional levers of power and of organization to advance her interests. I mean, she realizes that, you know, to get done what she wants to get done, that she needs to undertake sort of these tactics, and has been tremendously successful at them.
And I think to add to that, you know, she's also someone who just isn't afraid to speak her mind, even if that means going against her own party in certain circumstances. There's a moment that I think stuck in my head. It's still stuck there now from a few years ago, pre-pandemic, during a floor debate on a budget. And, you know, there was a lot of talk about the rainy day fund and stashing money away, you know, for future hardships. And then, you know, lo and behold, COVID happened. But Lee's point was that, you know, it's raining in certain communities right now, especially, you know, minority communities, poorer communities. And, you know, she ended up voting against her own party leaders for that budget. She voted against it because she thought more needed to be done, you know, to help people who are suffering. And I think that's a trend that you'll see continue in Congress. And I think to John's point, I think the mix of her being someone who's not afraid to buck her party and speak her mind, but also someone who is savvy enough to kind of use the mechanisms at her disposal to get her work done, I think could make her an interesting figure to watch if she does end up in Washington.
Well, and, you know, I find it fascinating. I didn't even know this was permissible, but at the same time, she was running for re-election for her state house seat. So how's that for hedging bets? So whether it's in Washington or in Harrisburg in January, she'll certainly be a force in Pennsylvania politics. Sticking with Allegheny County, it really didn't get a lot of coverage over the last few months, but, and I don't know that it was too contentious, but there were quite a few candidates for lieutenant governor on the GOP side. One of them, who was very much aligned with the nominee, Doug Mastriano, is certainly very colorful, but he lost. The nominee is a woman named Carrie Del Rosso, but maybe you both can provide some perspective on her and even prognosticate a bit. I don't even know that she's ever met Doug Mastriano and how they're going to play nice on the same ticket.
That'll be interesting. You know, Del Rosso is pretty new to Harrisburg. She knocked off House Democratic leader Frank Dermody a few years ago, but at least from, you know, my vantage point, you know, she's been kind of quiet in Harrisburg. You know, it doesn't seem to disrupt things too much, or, you know, it hasn't kind of made too much of a name for herself, but that I guess isn't quite the case now that she's running for lieutenant governor. And it probably helps that she, you know, had the endorsement of Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs, you know, money that serves as a kind of conduit for more Jeffrey Yaskash, as John mentioned earlier. So that's a big endorsement, and with it comes a lot of resources. And I think, you know, looking at this race where there's such a divided ticket in terms of GOP options for lieutenant governor, I mean, you had kind of far right conservatives and Teddy Daniels, who was Doug Mastriano's pick, and other candidates like Jeff Coleman, who were, you know, preaching a message of civility in politics. And I think Del Rosa's victory here, I would imagine at least, really speaks to the resources she had at her disposal.
This was a calculated risk for Mastriano as well. I mean, Daniels came to the table with no small amount of baggage, not unlike Sean Parnell, who was going to be the U.S. Senate candidate for the Republicans for a little while. He was the subject of a PFA action by his former wife, that I got estranged wife. I mean, that ended up getting dropped by a Wayne County judge, but I think it might have been damaging enough for him. I mean, also because of the way,
I think there were also allegations in some Maryland jurisdiction, if memory serves me. So you got to be doing something in two different states.
I can't speak to that, but I mean, for your listeners' purposes, I mean, the lieutenant governor and governor run in their own right for the nomination in the primary, and then only run as a ticket in the general election. So Mastriano gambled a little bit by hitching his fortunes to Daniels, hoping that he would come out at the right end of it. So too did Josh Shapiro, gambling on Austin Davis, who actually did end up winning his party's nomination on Tuesday. So Shapiro at least will get somebody with whom he is sort of ideologically and personality-wise sort of simpatico. But on the Republican side of things, you now have sort of, I think of, say, Tom Wolf and Mike Stack, where that was thrown together as kind of an arranged marriage and didn't work out at all well, or Ed Rendell and Catherine Baker Knoll, who served a ticket balancing purpose, but he basically like stuck her in a closet and tried to forget about her for 4 years. So it's going to be really interesting about, to see how Doug Mastriano deals with Kerry Del Rosa. Are they going to campaign together? Are they going to do events together? Is she going to be up there on the stump, like spitting out the election fraud Christian nationalist stuff like he is? Or, how are they going to run this campaign? Because it's the guy Mastriano won didn't get over the finish line, and now he's got somebody he didn't pick, and he and she are going to have to deal with that.
Yeah, and ideologically, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how align or whether they even do. I mean, they're clearly both conservatives, but I think, like John said, they come from just very different sort of mindsets as to how they approach politics. And I think that's more a commentary probably on Mastriano than it is Del Rosa.
Do I remember there was some movement at some point in the state house, maybe the state senate as well, to change that? In the state of Maryland and other states, you don't play this game, that it's one ticket and the voters go into the booth and they're looking at one ticket. So, similar to what you have in a U.S. presidential race.
Yeah, I think Senator Dave Argel, I think, over in the Senate, chairman of the Senate State Government Committee, was pushing that. But it is one of a zillion, I feel like, constitutional amendments that's been making the rounds this session that has not quite gotten over the goal line yet.
Yeah, I think the whole mindset with that one is to try and avoid the type of strife that we saw between Wolf and Mike Stack, who didn't get along, and Stack ended up getting his security revoked and whatever else happened with that. And we might see again another sort of weird marriage between Mastriano and Del Rosso. And I think Argel and others who back that amendment, their whole mindset is to try and avoid the sort of intra-party fighting that can occur because of how we elect lieutenant governors right now.
You guys have been super generous with your time. We could certainly go another 40 minutes talking about Dr. Oz and Dave McCormick and what happened in the Fetterman-Lamb-Kenyatta race. I'm going to pivot, though. We're going to end on this. We have budget season upon us, and we have all sorts of Harrisburg insiders, sitting members, lobbyists, other staffers who listen to the show. What does this mean as people are, lobbying and engaging the Senator Brown, and, or I should say Chairman Brown and Chairman Saylor? I mean, 9 incumbents total, essentially just being dead men walking. It's just going to be a very awkward June, I guess is what I'm saying. But I'm not a Harrisburg insider. What does this all mean?
Justin, you want to take a run at it?
Sure. I mean, my approach to budget season now might be a little different than it was a week ago. But, you know, putting myself in Tom Wolf's head, if I can do that, you know, I imagined with him being a lame duck and Democrats obviously wanting to hold on to the governor's office, that I just envision him trying to negotiate a budget that doesn't cause a lot of disruption or public criticism or anything, because I don't think he would want to do anything that would hurt Josh Shapiro's chances in the general. Ooh, as to how Brown and Saylor's potential exodus might impact this, I truly have no idea.
I mean, it's completely uncharted waters here. If there's an upside, it's that the state is rolling in cash, which makes getting a budget, most of the time under ideal circumstances, makes getting a budget passed a lot easier, except in those times when it makes it harder because the state is rolling in cash. But it's also an election year. Historically, election year budgets have been pretty low friction affairs because everyone just wants to get out of Dodge and get home and campaign. So, you know, we may well see that again, you know, this June as well. So who knows?
Go ahead, John. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, and as far as Brown and Saylor, I guess they'll be doing their jobs right up until the bitter end, but won't wield quite so much clout as they would have in past cycles, but who knows?
Yeah, I was going to say, who knows? They might try and slip in some last like legacy pieces or something like a.
Read the fiscal code, kids. Read the fiscal code.
Okay, guys, this was great. You deserve more than a strong shot of espresso. You deserve something stronger. But I know it's been a late night, so really grateful for your time and your perspective.
Thanks very much for asking. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us. All right.
Thank you for tuning in to a special episode of Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics. Please join us for future episodes by subscribing, and while you're at it, give us a rating and a review. We love listener feedback, so drop us a note via our website, papoliticspodcast.org. And a very special thanks to Jake Schwartz for all his production assistance. I'm Ari Middleman, and this is Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics.